cough. "Masha, get us some supper, and bring the wine if any is left, or send for some." The woman rose, came out from behind the partition, and saw Constantine. "Here's a gentleman, Nikolai Dmitrich," she said.
"Whom do you want?"
said Nikolai Levin's voice angrily.
"It is I," answered Constantine Levin, coming forward into the lamplight.
"Who's I?"
said the voice of Nikolai Levin, still more angrily. Constantine heard how he rose hurriedly and caught against something, and then, in the doorway before him, he saw the familiar yet ever strange figure of his brother, wild, sickly, gigantic, lean and round-shouldered, with large, frightened eyes. He was even more emaciated than 3 years before, when Constantine Levin had last seen him. He was wearing a short coat, and his hands and broad bones appeared more immense than ever. His hair was thinner, but the same straight moustache covered his lips, and the same eyes with their peculiar, naive gaze looked out at the newcomer.
"Ah, Kostya!"
he said, suddenly recognizing his brother, and his eyes lit up with joy. But at the same moment he turned to look at the young man, and convulsively jerked his head and neck as if his necktie were strangling him, a movement Levin knew well, and quite another expression, a wild, suffering, and cruel look settled on his haggard face.
"I wrote both to you and to Sergei Ivanovich that I do not know you and do not wish to know you. What is it? What do you want?"
He was not at all as Constantine had imagined him. Constantine, when thinking of him, had forgotten the most trying and worst part of his character, that which made intercourse with him so difficult. But now, when he saw his face, and especially that convulsive movement of his head, he remembered it all.
"I do not want anything of you, specially," he answered, meekly. "I have simply come to see you."
His brother's timidity obviously softened Nikolai, whose lips quivered.
"Ah, you come just for that," he said. "Well, come in. Sit down. Will you have some supper? Masha, get supper for three. No, wait a little. Do you know who this is?"
he added, turning to his brother and pointing to the man in the workman's coat.
"It is Mr. Kritsky, my friend ever since my Kiev days, a very remarkable fellow. Of course, the police are after him, because he's not a scoundrel."
And he glanced round at everybody present, as was his way. Seeing that the woman in the doorway was about to go out, he shouted to her,
"Wait! I told you!"
And in the awkward and blundering manner familiar to Constantine, he again looked round at everybody and began to tell his brother about Kritsky, how he had been expelled from the university because he had started a society to help the poorer students, and also Sunday schools, and how he had afterwards taught in an elementary school, and had been turned out from that, too, and had then been tried on some charge or other.
"You were at Kiev University?" Konstantin Levin asked Kritsky, in order to break the awkward silence that followed.
"Yes, at Kiev,"
Kritsky replied, with an angry frown.
"And this woman," said Nikolai Levin, interrupting him and pointing to her, "is my life's companion, Marie Nikolaevna. I took her out of a house."
And as he said this, he again jerked his neck.
"But I love and respect her, and beg all those who wish to know me," he added, raising his voice and scowling, "to love and respect her. She's just the same to me as a wife, just the same. So, now you know whom you have to deal with, and if you fear you will be degraded, there is the door."
And again his eyes glanced questioningly around.
"Why should I be degraded? I don't understand."
"Well, Masha, order supper for three with vodka and wine. No, never mind. You may go."
Chapter 25.
"So, you see,"
Nikolai Levin continued with an effort, wrinkling his brow and twitching, He evidently found it hard to decide what to say and to do.
"You see,"
he pointed to a bundle of iron rods tied together with string in a corner of the room.
"You see that? It is the beginning of a new business we are undertaking. The business is to be a productive association."
Constantine hardly listened. He kept glancing at his brother's sickly, consumptive face and felt more and more sorry for him. Nor could he force himself to pay attention to what Nikolai was telling him about the association. He realized that this association was merely an anchor to save his brother from self-contempt. Nikolai Levin continued speaking.
"You know that capitalism oppresses the workers. Our workmen, the peasants, bear the whole burden of labor, but are so placed that, work as they may, they cannot escape from their degrading condition. All the profits on their labor, by which they might better their condition, give themselves some leisure, and consequently gain some education, all this surplus value is taken away by the capitalists. And our society has so shaped itself that the more the people work, the richer the merchants and landowners will become, while the people will remain beasts of burden forever. And this system must be changed,"
he concluded with an inquiring look at his brother. "Yes, of course," said Constantine, looking intently at the hectic flush which had appeared on his brother's face below its prominent cheekbones.
"And so we're starting a locksmiths' association in which all the products and the profits, and above all the instruments of production, will be common property."
"Where will the business be?" asked Constantine.
"In the village of Votsrema, Kazan government."
"Why in a village?
It seems to me there is plenty of work to do in the country as it is. Why start a locksmiths' association there?"
"Because the peasants are still just as much slaves as they used to be, and that is why you and Sergei Ivanich don't like it when anyone wishes to deliver them from their slavery," replied Nikolai Levin, irritated by Constantine's objection.
Constantine sighed, and at the same time looked round the room, which was dismal and dirty. The sigh seemed to irritate Nikolai still more.
"I know your aristocratic outlook, and Sergei Ivanich's. I know that he uses all the powers of his mind to justify the existing evils."
"But why talk about Sergei Ivanich?" said Levin with a smile.
"Sergei Ivanich? This is why!"
suddenly shouted Nikolai at the mention of the name.
"This is why! But what is the good of talking? One thing only. Why have you come here? You despise it. Well, that is all right. Then go away. Go! Go, in God's name!"
he exclaimed, rising from his chair.
"Go! Go!"
"I do not despise it at all," Constantine replied meekly. "I do not even dispute it." Meanwhile, Maria Nikolaevna had come back. Nikolai gave her an angry look. She hurried up to him and said something in a whisper.
"I am not well and have grown irritable," said Nikolai, breathing heavily and quieting down. "And you talk to me about Sergei Ivanich and his article. It is such rubbish, such humbug, such self-deception. What can a man write about justice who does not understand it? Have you read his article?"
he said, turning to Kritsky again, sitting down to the table and clearing away from it a heap of half-filled cigarettes to make room.
"I have not read it,"
said Kritsky morosely, evidently not wishing to join in the conversation.
"Why not?"
irritably answered Nikolai, still addressing Kritsky.
"Because I consider it unnecessary to waste time on it."
"What do you mean? May I ask how you knew it would waste your time? That article is incomprehensible to many. I mean, it is above them. But it is a different matter with me. I see through his thought and therefore know why it is weak."
Everyone remained silent. Kritsky rose and took up his hat.
"Don't you want any supper? Well, bye. Come tomorrow and bring the locksmith."
As soon as Kritsky had gone out, Nikolai smiled and winked.
"He also is not much good," he remarked.
"I can see."
But at that moment Kritsky called him from outside the door.
"What do you want now?"
said Nikolai, and went out into the passage. Left alone with Maria Nikolaevna, Levin spoke to her.
"Have you been long with my brother?"
he asked. "Yes, it is the second year now. His health is very bad. He drinks too much," she said.
"Really? What does he drink?"
"He drinks vodka, and it's bad for him."
"Much vodka?" whispered Levin.
"Yes," she said, looking timidly toward the door, just as Nikolai returned.
"What are you talking about?"
he asked, frowning, and looking from one to the other with frightened eyes.
"What was it?"
"Nothing," replied Levin, in confusion.
"If you do not wish to tell me, do as you please, only you have no business to talk to her. She's a street girl, and you are a gentleman," he muttered, jerking his neck. "You see, I have examined and weighed everything here, and regard my errors with compassion," he continued, again raising his voice.
"Nikolai Dmitrich, Nikolai Dmitrich," whispered Maria Nikolaevna, again approaching him.
"Well, all right, all right. And how about supper? Ah, here it is," he said,
noticing a waiter who was bringing in a tray.
"Here, here, put it down, here,"
he said crossly, and at once poured out a wine glass full of vodka and drank it greedily.
"Have a drink, will you?"
he said to his brother, brightening up at once.
"We've had enough of Sergei Ivanich. I'm glad to see you, anyhow. Whatever one may say, after all, we are not strangers. Come, have a drink. Tell me what you're doing,"
he continued, greedily chewing a crust of bread and filling himself another glass.
"Are you getting on?"
"I'm living alone in the country, as I did before, and I look after the farming," answered Konstantin, observing with horror how greedily his brother ate and drank, and trying not to let it be seen that he noticed it.
"Why don't you get married?"
"I had not the chance," replied Konstantin, blushing.
"Why not?" "For me, all that is over. I have spoilt my life. I have said, and still say, that if I had been given my share of the property when I wanted it, everything would have been different."
Konstantin hastened to change the subject.
"Do you know that your Vanyusha is now a clerk in my office at Pokrovsk?" he said.
Nikolai jerked his head and grew thoughtful.
"Yes, tell me what is happening in Pokrovsk. Is the house still standing? And the birch trees and our schoolroom? And is Philip the gardener really still living? How well I remember the garden house and the sofa. Mind, don't change anything in the house, but get married soon and set things going again as they used to be. Then I will come to you if you have a good wife."
"Come to me at once," said Levin.
"How well we might settle down there."
"I would come if I was sure I should not find Sergei Ivanich there."
"You won't find him there. I live quite apart from him."
"Still, say what you will, you must choose between him and me,"
said Nikolai, with a timid look at his brother. His timidity touched Konstantin.
"If you want my full confession about it, I will tell you that I take no side in your quarrel with Sergei Ivanich. You are both to blame. You more in external matters, and he more in essential ones."
"Ah! Ah, then you have grasped it! You have grasped it!"
joyfully exclaimed Nikolai. "But personally, if you care to know it, I value your friendship more, because..."
"Why? Why?"
Konstantin could not tell him that it was because Nikolai was unfortunate and needed friendship. But Nikolai understood that he meant just that, and, frowning, again took hold of the vodka bottle.
"Enough! Nikolai Dmitrich,"
said Maria Nikolaevna, stretching out her plump arm with its bare wrist to take the bottle.
"Let go! Leave me alone! I'll thrash you!" shouted he.
Maria Nikolaevna gave a mild, kindly smile, which evoked one from Nikolai, and she took away the bottle.
"Do you think she doesn't understand?" said Nikolai. "She understands it all better than any of us. There really is something good and sweet about her."
"You were never in Moscow before?" Konstantin asked, very politely, just in order to say something.
"Don't speak to her in that way. It frightens her.
No one but the magistrate, when she was tried for an attempt to escape from the house of ill fame, ever spoke to her so politely."
"Oh, heavens, how senseless everything is in this world," he suddenly exclaimed. "All these new institutions, these magistrates, these zemstvos, what a confusion it all is."
And he began to relate all his encounters with these new institutions. Konstantin Levin listened to him, and the condemnation of the social institutions which he shared with him and had often expressed was unpleasant to him when he heard it from his brother's lips. "We shall understand it better in the next world," he said playfully.
"In the next world? Oh, I do dislike that next world," said Nikolai, fixing his wild, frightened eyes on his brother's face. "One would think that to leave all these abominations, these muddles, one's own and other people's, would be good, yet I fear death. I fear it terribly."
He shuddered.
"Oh, do drink something. Would you like some champagne? Or let us go out somewhere or other. Let us go to the gypsies. Do you know I've become fond of the gypsies and the Russian folk songs?"
His speech began to grow confused, and he jumped from one subject to another. With Masha's help, Konstantin succeeded in persuading him not to go out anywhere and got him into bed quite tipsy. Masha promised to write to Konstantin in case of need, and to try to persuade Nikolai to go and live with him. Chapter 26. Next morning, Konstantin Levin left Moscow, and toward evening he reached home. On his way back in the train, he talked with his fellow passengers about politics and the new railways, and felt oppressed, just as in Moscow, by the confusion of the views expressed, by discontent with himself, and a vague sense of shame. But when he got out of the train at his station, and by the dim light from the station windows saw his one-eyed coachman, Ignat, with his coat collar turned up, and his sledge with its carpet-lined back, his horses with their tied-up tails, and the harness with its rings and tassels. And when Ignat, while still putting the luggage into the sledge, began telling him the village news, how the contractor had come and Pava had carved, Levin felt that the confusion was beginning to clear away, and his shame and self-dissatisfaction to pass. He felt this at the mere sight of Ignat and the horses. But when he had put on the sheepskin coat that had been brought for him, and, well wrapped up, had seated himself in the sledge and started homeward, turning over in his mind the orders he would give about the work on the estate, and as he watched the side horse, once a saddle horse that had been overridden, a spirited animal from the Don, he saw what had befallen him in quite a different light. He felt that he was himself, and did not wish to be anyone else. He only wished now to be better than he had been formerly. First of all, he decided that he would no longer hope for the exceptional happiness which marriage was to have given him, and consequently he would not underrate the present as he had done. Secondly, he would never again allow himself to be carried away by passion, the repulsive memory of which had so tormented him when he was making up his mind to propose. Then, remembering his brother Nikolai, he determined that he would never allow himself to forget him again, but would watch over him, keep him in sight, and be ready to help when things went hard with him. And he felt that that would be soon. Then his brother's talk about communism, which he had taken lightly at the time, now made him think. He considered an entire change of economic conditions nonsense. but he'd always felt the injustice of his superfluities compared with the peasant's poverty, and now decided, in order to feel himself quite justified, that though he had always worked hard and lived simply, he would in future work still more and allow himself still less luxury. And it all seemed to him so easy to carry out that he was in a pleasant reverie the whole way home, and it was with cheerful hopes for a new and better life that he reached his house toward 9 o'clock in the evening. A light fell on the snow-covered space in front of the house from the windows of the room of his old nurse, Agafya Mikhailovna, who now acted as his housekeeper. She had not yet gone to bed, and Kuzma, whom she had roused, came running out barefoot and still half asleep into the porch. Laska, a setter bitch, ran out too, almost throwing Kuzma off his feet, and whined and rubbed herself against Lievin's knees, jumping up and wishing but not daring to put her front paws on his chest.
"You have soon come back, sir?" said Agafya Mikhailovna.
"I was homesick, Agafya Mikhailovna. Visiting is all very well, but there is no place like home," he replied, and went into his study.
A candle just brought in gradually lit up the study, and its familiar details became visible. The stag's horns, the bookshelves, the looking-glass, the hot-air aperture of the stove with its brass lid which had long been in need of repair, his father's couch, the large table on which were an open volume, a broken ashtray, and an exercise book in his handwriting. When he saw all this, he was overcome by a momentary doubt of the possibility of starting the new life of which he had been dreaming on his way. All these traces of his old life seemed to seize hold of him and say, "No, you will not escape us and will not be different, but will remain such as you have been, full of doubts, full of dissatisfaction with yourself, and of vain attempts at improvement followed by failures, and continual hopes of the happiness which has escaped you and is impossible for you." That was what the thing said. But another voice within his soul was saying that one must not submit to the past, and that one can do anything with oneself. And obeying the latter voice, he went to the corner where 2 36-pound dumbbells lay, and began doing gymnastic exercises with them to invigorate himself. He heard a creaking of steps at the door, and hurriedly put down the dumbbells. His steward entered and said that, "The Lord be thanked, everything was all right, but that the buckwheat had burnt in the new drying kiln." This news irritated Lievin. The new kiln had been built and partly invented by him. The steward had always been against the new kiln, and now proclaimed with suppressed triumph that the buckwheat had got burnt. Lievin felt quite certain that if it had been burnt, it was only because the precautions about which he had given instructions over and over again had been neglected. He was vexed, and he reprimanded the steward. But the steward had one important and pleasant event to report. Pava, his best and most valuable cow, bought at the cattle show, had calved.
"Kuzma, bring me my sheepskin, and you tell them to bring a lantern. I will go and have a look at her," he said to the steward.
The sheds where the most valuable cattle were kept were just behind the house. Crossing the yard, past the heap of snow by the lilac bush, he reached the shed. There was a warm, steaming smell of manure when the frozen door opened, and the cows, astonished at the unaccustomed light of the lantern, began moving on their clean straw. Lievin saw the broad, smooth, black-mottled back of a Dutch cow. The bull, Berkut, with a ring through his nose, was lying down and almost rose up, but changed his mind and only snorted a couple of times as they passed by. The red beauty, Pava, enormous as a hippopotamus, turned her back, hiding her calf from the newcomers and sniffing at it. Lievin entered the stall and examined Pava, who, becoming excited, was about to low, but quieted down when Lievin moved the calf toward her, and, sighing heavily, began licking it with her rough tongue. The calf fumbled about, pushing its nose under its mother's belly and swinging its little tail.
"Show a light here. Theodore, here," said Lievin, examining the calf.
"Like its mother," he said, "although the color is its father's.
very fine, big-boned and deep-flanked. Vasily Fedorych, isn't she fine?" he said, turning to the steward, and quite forgiving him for the buckwheat under the influence of his satisfaction about the calf.
"Whom could she take after not to be good? Simeon, the contractor, came the day after you left. We shall have to employ him, Konstantin Dmitrich," said the steward. "I told you about the machine."
This one question led Levin back to all the details of his farming, which was on a large and elaborate scale. He went straight from the cowshed to the office, and after talking things over with the steward and with Simeon, the contractor, he returned to the house and went directly upstairs to the drawing-room. Chapter 27. It was a large, old-fashioned house, and though only Levin was living in it, he used and heated the whole of it. He knew this to be foolish and even wrong, and contrary to his new plans, but this house was a whole world to Levin. It was the world in which his father and mother had lived and died. They had lived a life which appeared to him ideally perfect, and which he had dreamt of renewing with a wife and family of his own. Levin could scarcely remember his mother. His conception of her was to him a sacred memory, and in his imagination his future wife was to be a repetition of the enchanting and holy ideal of womanhood that his mother had been. He could not imagine the love of woman without marriage, and even pictured to himself a family first and then the woman who would give him the family. His views on marriage, therefore, did not resemble those of most of his acquaintances, for whom marriage was only one of many social affairs. For Levin, it was the chief thing in life, on which the whole happiness of life depended. And now he had to renounce it. When he had settled in the armchair in the little drawing-room where he always had his tea, and Agafya Mikhailovna had brought it in for him and had sat down at the window with her usual remark, "I will sit down, sir," he felt that, strange to say, he had not really forgotten his dreams, and that he could not live without them. With her or with another, they would come true. He read his book and followed what he read, stopping now and then to listen to Agafya Mikhailovna, who chattered indefatigably, and at the same time various pictures of farming and future family life arose disconnectedly in his mind. He felt that in the depth of his soul something was settling down, adjusting and composing itself. He listened to Agafya Mikhailovna's talk of how Prokhor had forgotten the Lord, was spending on drink the money Levin had given him to buy a horse with, and had beaten his wife nearly to death. He listened and read, and remembered the whole sequence of thoughts raised by what he was reading. It was a book of Tyndall's on heat. He recalled his disapproval of Tyndall's self-conceit concerning the cleverness of his experiments and his lack of a philosophic outlook. And suddenly the joyous thought came uppermost. "In 2 years' time I shall have 2 Dutch cows in my herd, and Pava herself may still be alive. There will be 12 cows by Berkut, and these 3 to crown all. Splendid!" He returned to his book. Well, let us grant that electricity and heat are one and the same, but can we substitute the one quantity for the other in solving an equation? No. Then what of it? The connection between all the forces of nature can be felt instinctively without all that. It will be especially good when Pava's calf is already a red mottled cow, and the whole herd in which these 3 will be... Splendid! To go out with my wife and the visitors and meet the herd, my wife will say, "We, Konstantin and I, reared this calf like a baby." "How can you be interested in these things?" the visitor will ask. "All that interests him interests me." But who is she? And he remembered what had happened in Moscow. Well, what is to be done? It is not my fault. But now everything will be on new lines.
It is nonsense to say that life will prevent it, that the past prevents it. I must struggle to live a better, far better life.
He lifted his head and pondered. Old Laska, who had not yet quite digested her joy at her master's return and had run out to bark in the yard, now came back, bringing a smell of fresh air with her into the room, and, wagging her tail, she approached him and, putting her head under his hand, whined plaintively, asking to be patted.
"She all but speaks," said Agafya Mikhailovna. "She's only a dog, but she understands that her master has come back feeling depressed."
"Why depressed?"
"Oh, don't I see. I ought to understand gentlefolk by this time. I've grown up among them from a child. Never mind, my dear, as long as you have good health and a clean conscience."
Levin looked at her intently, surprised that she knew so well what was in his mind.
"Shall I bring you a little more tea?" she said, and went out with his cup.
Laska kept on pushing her head under his hand. He patted her a little, and she curled herself up at his feet with her head on her outstretched hind paw. And to show that all was now well and satisfactory, she slightly opened her mouth, smacked her sticky lips, and drawing them more closely over her old teeth, lay still in blissful peace. Levin attentively watched this last movement of hers.
"And it is just the same with me," he said to himself. "It is just the same with me. What does it matter? All is well."
Chapter 28. Early in the morning after the ball, Anna sent a telegram to her husband to say that she was leaving Moscow that same evening.
"Really, I must go," she said, explaining her altered plans to her sister-in-law in a tone suggesting that she had suddenly remembered so many things she had to do that it was not even possible to enumerate them all. "Really, I had better go today."
Stepan Oblonsky was not dining at home, but promised to be back at 7 to see his sister off. Kitty also had not come, but had sent a note to say that she had a headache. Dolly and Anna dined alone with the children and their English governess. Whether it is that children are inconstant, or that they are sensitive and felt that Anna was not the same person today as she had been that other day when they had been so fond of her, and that she no longer took any interest in them, at any rate they suddenly left off playing with their aunt and loving her, and were not at all concerned about her leaving. Anna spent the whole morning preparing for her departure, writing notes to her Moscow acquaintances, making up accounts, and packing. It seemed to Dolly that Anna was not at ease in her mind, but in a state of anxiety that Dolly knew well from her own experience, a state which does not come on without a cause, but generally hides dissatisfaction with oneself. After dinner, Anna went to her room to dress, and Dolly followed her.
"How strange you are today," said Dolly.
"I? Do you think so?"
"I'm not strange, but wicked. It sometimes happens to me. I feel ready to cry."
"It is very silly, but it will pass," said Anna hurriedly,
and she bent her flushed face over the tiny bag into which she was packing a nightcap and some lawn handkerchiefs. Her eyes shone peculiarly and kept filling with tears.
"I did not want to leave Petersburg, and now I do not want to leave here."
"You came here and did a good action," said Dolly, scrutinizing her attentively.
Anna looked at her with her eyes wet with tears.
"Do not say that, Dolly. I have done and could do nothing. I often wonder why people conspire to spoil me. What have I done, and what could I do? There was enough love in your heart to forgive. But for you, God only knows what would have happened. How lucky you are, Anna," said Dolly. "Everything in your soul is clear and good."
"Everyone has a skeleton in their cupboard, as the English say. Oh, what skeleton have you? Everything about you is so clear.
I have one, said Anna. And unexpectedly following her tears, a sly, humorous smile puckered her lips.
Well, at least your skeleton is a funny one, and not a dismal one, said Dolly, smiling.
No, it is a dismal one. Do you know why I'm going today and not tomorrow? This is a confession of something that oppresses me, and I want to make it to you, said Anna, determinedly throwing herself back in an armchair and looking straight into Dolly's eyes. And to her surprise, Dolly saw that Anna was blushing to her ears and to the curly black locks on her neck. Do you know, continued Anna, why Kitty did not come to dinner? She is jealous of me. I was the cause of the ball being a torture instead of a pleasure to her. But really, I was not to blame, or only a very little, she said, drawling out the word very in a high-pitched voice.
Oh, how like Steva you said that, remarked Dolly, laughing.
Anna was annoyed.
Oh, no, I am not Steva, she said, frowning. The reason I have told you is that I do not even for a moment allow myself to distrust myself.
But at the moment when she uttered these words, she knew they were untrue. She not only distrusted herself, but was agitated by the thought of Vronsky, and was leaving sooner than she had intended, only that she might not meet him again.
Yes, Steva told me that you danced the mazurka with him, and that he...
You cannot think how queerly it came about. I only thought of arranging the match, and suddenly it all came out quite differently. Perhaps, against my own will, I...
She blushed and stopped.
Oh, they feel that at once, said Dolly.
But I should be in despair if there were anything serious in it on his side, Anna interrupted her. I am sure that it will all be forgotten, and Kitty will no longer hate me.
Well, do you know, Anna, to tell you the truth, I'm not very anxious that Kitty should marry him.
It is much better that it should come to nothing if he, Vronsky, is capable of falling in love with you in a day.
Oh, my goodness, how stupid it would be, said Anna. And again a deep flush of pleasure suffused her face at hearing the thought that occupied her mind expressed in words.
So I'm going away having made an enemy of Kitty, of whom I'm so fond. Oh, what a darling she is! But you will put it right, eh, Dolly?
Dolly could hardly repress a smile. She was fond of Anna, but it was pleasant to find that she too had a weakness.
An enemy? Oh, that is impossible.
I should so like you all to love me as I love you.
And now I love you still more, said Anna, with tears in her eyes. Oh, dear, how silly I am today.
She dabbed her face with her handkerchief and began to dress. Oblonsky, smelling of wine and cigars, with his face red and happy, came in late, just as she was about to start. Anna's emotion had spread to Dolly, who, as she embraced her sister-in-law for the last time, whispered,
Remember that I love and always shall love you as my best friend.
I do not know why you should, said Anna, kissing her and trying to hide her tears.
You understood and understand me. Goodbye, my sweet one.
Chapter 29 Well, that's all over, thank heaven, was Anna's first thought when she had taken leave of her brother, who stood to the last moment obstructing the entrance to the railway carriage. She sat down beside her maid, Anushka, and peered round the dimly lit sleeping compartment. Thank heaven, tomorrow I shall see Tsaretsa and Alexei Alexandrovich again, and my good, accustomed life will go on as of old. With the same preoccupied mind she had had all that day, Anna prepared with pleasure and great deliberation for the journey. With her deft little hands she unlocked her red bag, took out a small pillow which she placed on her knees, and locked the bag again. Then she carefully wrapped up her feet and sat down comfortably. An invalid lady was already going to bed. Two other ladies began talking to Anna. One, a fat old woman, while wrapping up her feet, remarked upon the heating of the carriage. Anna said a few words in answer, but not foreseeing anything interesting from the conversation, asked her maid to get out her reading lamp, fixed it to the arm of her seat, and took a paper knife and an English novel from her handbag. At first she could not read. For a while the bustle of people moving about disturbed her, and when the train had finally started it was impossible not to listen to the noises. Then there was the snow, beating against the window on her left to which it stuck, and the sight of the guard who passed through the carriage closely wrapped up and covered with snow on one side. Also the conversation about the awful snowstorm which was raging outside distracted her attention. And so it went on and on, the same jolting and knocking, the same beating of the snow on the window pane, the same rapid changes from steaming heat to cold and back again to heat, the gleam of the same faces through the semi-darkness, and the same voices. But at last Anna began to read and to follow what she read. Anushka was already dozing, her broad hands with a hole in one of the gloves holding the red bag on her lap. Anna read and understood, but it was unpleasant to read, that is to say, to follow the reflection of other people's lives. She was too eager to live herself. When she read how the heroine of the novel nursed a sick man, she wanted to move about the sick room with noiseless footsteps. When she read of a member of Parliament making a speech, she wished to make that speech. When she read how Lady Mary rode to hounds, teased her sister-in-law, and astonished everybody by her boldness, she wanted to do it herself. But there was nothing to be done, so she forced herself to read, while her little hand toyed with the smooth paper knife. The hero of the novel had nearly attained to his English happiness of a baronetcy and an estate, and Anna wanted to go to the estate with him, when she suddenly felt that he must have been ashamed, and that she was ashamed of the same thing. But what was he ashamed of? What am I ashamed of? She asked herself with indignant surprise. She put down her book, leant back, and clasped the paper knife tightly in both hands. There was nothing to be ashamed of. She called up all her Moscow memories. They were all good and pleasant. She recalled the ball and Vronsky and his humble, enamoured gaze, and their relations with one another. There was nothing to be ashamed of. And yet at that very point of her recollections when she remembered Vronsky, the feeling of shame grew stronger, and some inner voice seemed to say to her, "Warm, very warm, burning." "Well, what of it?" she finally said to herself with decision, changing her position on the seat. "What does it signify? Am I afraid to look straight at it? What of it?" Just as if there existed, or could exist, between me and this officer lad any relations differing from those with other acquaintances. She smiled disdainfully and again took up her book. But now she absolutely could not understand what she was reading. She passed her paper knife over the window pane, then pressed its cold, smooth surface against her cheek and almost laughed aloud, suddenly overcome with unreasoning joy. She felt that her nerves were being stretched like strings drawn tighter and tighter round pegs. She felt her eyes opening wider, her fingers and toes nervously moving, and something inside her stopping her breath, and all the forms and sounds in the swaying semi-darkness around struck her with unusual vividness.
Momentary doubts kept occurring in her mind as to whether the train was moving forwards or backwards, or standing still. Was it Anushka who was sitting beside her, or a stranger? And am I here myself? Am I myself, or another? She was afraid of giving way to these delirious thoughts. Something seemed to draw her to them, but she had the power to give way to them or to resist. To get over it, she rose, threw off her wrap, and took off the cape of her coat. She came to her senses for a moment and knew that the lean peasant in the long nankeen coat with a button missing who had come into the compartment was the carriage stoker and was looking at the thermometer, and that the wind and snow rushed in when he opened the door. But afterwards everything again became confused. The peasant in the long coat started gnawing at something on the wall. The old woman began stretching her legs the whole length of the carriage, which she filled with a black cloud. Then something squeaked and clattered in a dreadful manner, as if someone was being torn to pieces. Then a blinding red light appeared, and at last everything was hidden by a wall. Anna felt as if she had fallen through the floor. But all this did not seem dreadful, but amusing. The voice of a man wrapped up and covered with snow shouted something just above her ear. She rose and came to herself, understanding that they had stopped at a station and that this was the guard. She asked Anushka to give her the cape she had removed and a shawl, and putting them on, she moved to the door.
"Are you going out?"
asked Anushka.
"Yes, I want a breath of air. It's so hot in here."
She opened the carriage door. The snow and wind rushed toward her and had a tussle with her for the door, and this, too, struck her as amusing. She went out. The wind seemed only to have waited for her. It whistled merrily and tried to seize and carry her off, but she held on to the cold doorpost and held down her shawl. Then, stepping onto the platform, she moved away from the carriage. The wind blew boisterously into the little porch of the carriage, but on the platform, sheltered by the train, it was quiet. With enjoyment, she drew in full breaths of the snowy, frosty air as she stood beside her carriage, looking round at the platform and the lighted station. Chapter 30. A blustering storm was rushing and whistling between the wheels of the train and round the pillars and the corners of the station. The railway carriages, the pillars, the people and everything that could be seen were covered on one side with snow, and that covering became thicker and thicker. A momentary lull would be followed by such a terrific gust that it seemed hardly possible to stand against it. Yet people, merrily exchanging remarks, ran over the creaking boards of the platform, and the big station doors were constantly being opened and shut. The shadow of a man, stooping, slipped past her feet, and she heard a hammer striking the carriage wheels.
"Let me have the telegram,"
came an angry voice from the other side out of the stormy darkness.
"Here, please, number 28,
cried other voices, while many people, muffled up and covered with snow, ran hither and thither. Two gentlemen passed her with glowing cigarettes between their lips. She took another deep breath to get her fill of fresh air, and had already drawn her hand out of her muff to take hold of the handrail and get into the train, when another man wearing a military overcoat came close between her and the wavering light of the lamp. She turned round and instantly recognized Vronsky. With his hand in salute, he bowed and asked if she wanted anything and whether he could be of any service to her. For some time she looked into his face without answering, and though he stood in the shade, she noticed, or thought she noticed, the expression of his face and eyes. It was the same expression of respectful ecstasy that had so affected her the night before. She had assured herself more than once during those last few days, and again a moment ago, that Vronsky, in relation to her, was only one of the hundreds of everlastingly identical young men she met everywhere, and that she would never allow herself to give him a thought.
Yet now, at the first moment of seeing him again, she was seized by a feeling of joyful pride. There was no need for her to ask him why he was there. She knew as well as if he had told her that he was there in order to be where she was. "I did not know that you were going to." "Why are you going?" she asked, dropping the hand with which she was about to take hold of the handrail. Her face beamed with a joy and animation she could not repress.
"Why am I going?" he repeated, looking straight into her eyes. "You know that I am going in order to be where you are," said he. "I cannot do otherwise."
At that moment the wind, as if it had mastered all obstacles, scattered the snow from the carriage roofs and set a loose sheet of iron clattering, and in front the deep whistle of the engine howled mournfully and dismally. The awfulness of the storm appeared still more beautiful to her now. He had said just what her soul desired, but her reason dreaded. She did not reply, and he saw a struggle in her face.
"Forgive me if my words displease you," he said humbly.
He spoke courteously and respectfully, but so firmly and stubbornly that she was long unable to reply. "What you are saying is wrong, and if you are a good man, I beg you to forget it, as I will forget it," she said at last.
"Not a word, not a movement of yours will I ever forget, nor can I."
"Enough, enough," she cried, vainly trying to give a severe expression to her face into which he was gazing eagerly. She took hold of the cold handrail, ascended the steps, and quickly entered the little lobby leading into the carriage. But in that little lobby she stopped, going over in her imagination what had just taken place. Though she could remember neither his nor her own words, she instinctively felt that that momentary conversation had drawn them terribly near to one another, and this both frightened her and made her happy. After standing still for a few seconds, she went into the carriage and sat down. The overwrought condition which tormented her before not only returned again, but grew worse and reached such a degree that she feared every moment that something within her would give way under the intolerable strain. She did not sleep at all that night, but the strain and the visions which filled her imagination had nothing unpleasant or dismal about them. On the contrary, they seemed joyful, glowing, and stimulating. Toward morning, Anna, while still sitting up, fell into a doze. When she woke, it was already light, and the train was approaching Petersburg. At once thoughts of home, her husband, her son, and the cares of the coming day, and of those that would follow, beset her. When the train stopped at the Petersburg terminus and she got out, the first face she noticed was that of her husband.
"Great heavens! What has happened to his ears?" she thought, gazing at his cold and commanding figure,
and especially at the gristly ears which now so struck her, pressing as they did against the rim of his hat. When he saw her, he came toward her with his customary ironical smile and looked straight at her with his large, tired eyes. An unpleasant feeling weighed on her heart when she felt his fixed and weary gaze, as if she had expected to find him different. She was particularly struck by the feeling of dissatisfaction with herself which she experienced when she met him. It was that ordinary, well-known feeling, as if she were dissembling, which she experienced in regard to her husband. But formerly she had not noticed it, while now she was clearly and painfully conscious of it.
"Yes, as you see, here is a devoted husband. Devoted as in the first year of married life. Consumed by desire to see you," said he, in his slow, high-pitched voice, and in the tone in which he always addressed her, a tone which ridiculed those who could use such words in earnest. "Is Seretse well?" she asked.
"'And is this all the reward I get?' he said, "'for my ardour? "'He is quite well, quite well.'
Chapter 31 Vronsky did not even try to sleep that night. He sat in his place, his eyes staring straight before him, not observing the people who went in or out. And if previously his appearance of imperturbable calm had struck and annoyed those who did not know him, he now seemed to them even prouder and more self-confident. He looked at people as if they were inanimate things. A nervous young man, a law court official, who sat opposite, hated him for that look. The young man repeatedly lit his cigarette at Vronsky's, talked to him, and even jostled him to prove that he was not a thing but a man. Yet Vronsky still looked at him as at a street lamp, and the young man made grimaces, feeling that he was losing self-control under the stress of this refusal to regard him as human. Vronsky neither saw nor heard anyone. He felt himself a king, not because he believed that he had made an impression on Anna. He did not yet believe that, but because the impression she had made on him filled him with happiness and pride. What would come of it all he did not know and did not even consider. He felt that all his powers, hitherto dissipated and scattered, were now concentrated and directed with terrible energy toward one blissful aim. This made him happy. He knew only that he had told her the truth, that he would go where she went, that all the happiness of life and the only meaning of life for him now was in seeing and hearing her. When he had got out of the train at Bologo station to drink a glass of seltzer water and had seen Anna, he had involuntarily at once told her just what he was thinking about it. He was glad he had said it to her and that she now knew it and was thinking about it. He did not sleep at all that night. When he returned to the train, he kept recalling all the positions in which he had seen her, and all her words, and in his imagination, causing his heart to stand still, floated pictures of a possible future. When he got out of the train at Petersburg, he felt, despite his sleepless night, as fresh and animated as after a cold bath. He stopped outside the carriage, waiting till she appeared. "I shall see her again," he thought, and smiled involuntarily. "I shall see her walk, her face. She will say something, turn her head, look at me, perhaps even smile." But before seeing her, he saw her husband, whom the station master was respectfully conducting through the crowd. Dear me, the husband! Only now did Vronsky for the first time clearly realize that the husband was connected with her. He knew she had a husband, but had not believed in his existence, and only fully believed in him when he saw him there. His head and shoulders, and the black trousers containing his legs, and especially when he saw that husband with an air of ownership quietly take her hand. When he saw Karenin with his fresh Petersburg face, his sternly self-confident figure, his round hat and his slightly rounded back, Vronsky believed in his existence, and had such a disagreeable sensation as a man tortured by thirst might feel on reaching a spring and finding a dog, sheep or pig in it, drinking the water and making it muddy. Karenin's gait, the swinging of his thighs, and his wide, short feet particularly offended Vronsky, who acknowledged only his own unquestionable right to love Anna. But she was still the same, and the sight of her still affected him physically, exhilarating and stimulating him and filling him with joy. He ordered his German valet, who had run up from a second-class carriage, to get his luggage and take it home, and he himself went up to her. He saw the husband and wife meet, and with the penetration of a lover he noticed the signs of slight embarrassment when she spoke to her husband. "No, she doesn't and can't love him," he decided mentally. While he was approaching her from behind, he observed with joy that she became aware of his approach and was about to turn, but, on recognizing him, again addressed her husband. "Did you have a good night?" he inquired, bowing toward them both, and leaving it to Karenin to take the greeting as meant for himself, and to recognize him or not as he pleased.
"Yes, quite comfortable, thank you," she replied.
Her face seemed tired, and had none of that play which showed now in a smile and now in the animation of